We'll hear arguments next in 7639, Memphis Gas, Light and Gas against Kraft. Pretty good guy for the state in terms of his confidence. Case we spent months going round and round this problem in those OBA standards.
On your committee, I guess.
First of all, this guy shouldn't have been so damn timid. He should have made a record of some kind. He didn't have to disclose the names to do that.
Assertion of to, at least the nature of the company.
Just the nature. I think any. And then if the judge didn't grant it, I'd certainly say it was a clear abuse. Mr. Graves, you may proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Frierson Graves, and I represent the Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division, which is a part of the city of Memphis, a municipal utility which has both electric, gas, and water operations. This action arose when Mr. and Mrs. Kraft and several others sued the Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division, alleging that their utility services were being terminated without due process of law, and they asked for both injunctive and declaratory relief. The district court implied that there was property in the utility services. It really didn't say one way or another, but the implication is there, but found that minimum due process was present in the procedures used by the Light, Gas, and Water, but it suggested a change in the notice that we were giving to our customers when the final notice was sent out, which was an additional stuffer or flyer. This change was made in the notice, a final order entered. It was an appeal to the Sixth Circuit, which found that utility services was property. However, this finding as to due process had two different holdings. As to Mrs. Parks, who had an admitted liability for an amount of a bill, the Sixth Circuit said that our final notice with applying to credit counselors and a hearing before credit counselors to arrange budget payments or extended payments was a sufficient constitutional due process, notice and hearing. But on the other hand, the Crafts, who allegedly had a dispute that our notice and our hearing was not sufficient, and we didn't have established procedures for a hearing, nor did our notice use the word dispute really in it in applying to the Crafts. We petitioned this court, and the two questions were whether or not utility services are property, and secondly, whether or not the procedures used by the Light, Gas, and Water meet the minimum requirements of due process, or what procedures must be used. I'd like to say first that a utility wants to keep its customers online. It wants to generate the revenue, whether it's a municipal utility or a private utility, because we in Memphis operate on a non-profit basis as a municipal utility just to pay expenses. So the more revenue we're able to generate from the customer, then the better to spread that for your administrative expenses among your ratepayers. Secondly, we think, and we think our procedures establish this, that a utility ought to do all it can to help its customers pay its bills. And one of the things that we did, which is in the record of this court, is to establish a budget procedure or a policy of having extended payments.
I suppose a fair corollary of what you have just suggested is that the paying customers should not be required to subsidize the non-paying customers.
Your Honor, I think that goes back to the sort of the general common law rules about a utility, that you shouldn't give free service, because just as you must provide service to a customer, if you, a reasonable service to him so that every person can have the service, likewise you should not give the service to a customer who is not paying for that, because you are discriminating against your rate payer in that way. And, of course, they say that reason both is for a reasonable rule for free service plus the fact that you're avoiding numerous small petty suits, because utility service is merely a credit transaction. Normally, you have an individual, either an oral contract. In Memphis, you can have your utilities connected by calling up on the telephone and say, will you connect the utilities to my address? The utilities are connected. You're asked to pay a deposit of $25 in this. That's sometimes placed upon your first bill. In this, you have a small credit transaction there for which we extend the new customer 65 days of service, almost, or that possibility, 60 or 65 days before we can cut a person off.
Mr. Graves, I want to be sure the damages feature of this case is gone, is it not?
The court suggested that the Crafts be allowed a $35 credit, and they were allowed that credit. So I don't consider that damages are still in this case, sir.
If damages are out, is the case rendered moot by your new procedures?
No, sir, because we still don't have what the petitioners wanted. We established a notice and procedure, and the Sixth Circuit said that they didn't comment on our new notice, but our old notice was still constitutionally deficient, and so that's their declaratory judgment and relief that our notice was not sufficient in this. And, of course, we're contending that utility service really is not property.
The Sixth Circuit's analysis on this point was based on its, at least in part, on its Palmer case, wasn't it?
Yes, sir.
And that didn't address Tennessee law at all, as I read it.
No, sir. That was a private utility that the court found was sort of callous, and we don't think that our policies do that. They were also, it was conceded that utility services were property in that case for a private utility.
What do you understand to be the reasoning of the Sixth Circuit here as to why a continued utility service is a property interest under the 14th Amendment?
Your Honor, they cited a number of cases which rely upon several reasons. One, that water or electricity is indispensable to life, and therefore you should have it. And they cite a number of cases, both district and other circuits, that tend to say both necessity of life or that there is some, by having this as a municipal utility, we have that state action, and also that you have the rule that you should give utilities to every customer.
Of course, the state action inquiry is quite different from the
That's
property
right.
interest.
That's right.
Mr. Graves?
Yes, sir.
Under Tennessee law, is there a legal right to receive a utility service so long as one pays for it?
Yes, sir. We go back to a 1902 Tennessee case of Jones versus Nashville, and that established more or less a franchise ordinance. And that establishes what I think was merely the common law general rule of utilities, that quasi-public type of corporation, that when you provide the service, you must give it to all customers, but you have, and the right is upon the utility to furnish those services to the customers, but the utility may make reasonable rules, and among those rules is they can deny the service to a person if he doesn't comply with it.
But this case involves a dispute as to whether or not the bill submitted by the utility was correct.
Yes, sir, and I think the rule, whether it is an admitted liability or a dispute, that the utility can determine the rules and regulations, and that the rights of either suing for an injunction, paying under protest and suing, or suing for damages, that the rule was made in common law for the utility's benefit and not as an entitlement or an independent source or a state statute to allow an entitlement to the customer, because the utility could terminate, but it did so at its peril, in this case, making it subject for damages.
Your position is that state law remedies were adequate and no constitutional.
Yes, sir.
There's no constitutional entitlement to a prior hearing.
Yes, sir. And that you cannot argue that water is indispensable to life or electricity is indispensable to life, because if that is so, then a person with an admitted liability for it that's merely using the services, why should you ever be able to cut them off? Congress this past year appropriated $200 million for the Community Development Act to help pay on utility bills for this past winter. But that is, if they want energy stamps or other matters in which to pay for utility services, it should be a taxpayer program and not a ratepayer program, but that it is upon the utility to maintain this.
Well, I take it then you say if the utility sends the person a notice and says you're cut off, and the person wants to know why, and the utility says it's none of your business, and then the person sues the utility and wins, and the utility freely admits that that we just cut you off for no reason at all. You would agree that under state law the utility would be liable?
Yes, sir. Under state law, the utility would have to adopt reasonable rules, because that's the normal rules.
I understand that. But you say despite that, there should be no constitutional requirement that the utility even notify the person as to what the basis for the cutoff is.
Your Honor, I think they've got to send them the bill and so they know what they have to pay. And once they know they're just due.
Well, I know, but I just, in my example, the utility simply notifies the person you're cut off, gives no reason whatsoever.
No, sir, he couldn't do that. They'd have to tell them what amount
was due.
So there is some
constitutional requirement then for an adequate prior notice or not?
No, sir, that the common law rule is that you must send any creditor his bill. In this, when you've sent the creditor his bill and you tell him you owe $9.89 for utilities, then you're telling him pay the $9.89 or you'll be terminated by a certain day.
You do say then that there is a requirement that the utility beforehand, before cutting off, go through some procedure to let the person know what his obligation is.
What his obligation is, but not the fact that he may dispute what that obligation is and have a continued right to get the water out of the city pipes in the street or the gas out of the pipes and continue this while he is doing a dispute. Because if they want to terminate it on the basis of this, they don't have to do the continued credit transaction, and they can't say, that's because it's a necessity of life. Or they say, there's some independent source, such as a state statute, to do this, because there was a state statute enough in Jackson when they codified common law rights to say what was.
Well, what if the utility cuts the person off without sending him the bill?
I think that gives rise to a damage action, too. I don't know whether it's constitutional or not.
I want to know. That's what the issue is in this case, at least part of it.
Well, I don't think the issue is whether or not you must send a bill. I admit that you must send a bill.
Why?
What's because the source of the obligation?
The source of the obligation is the credit transaction. The question is, do you have to continue selling on credit while you're litigating whether they owe the past credit or not?
If you agree with Mr. Justice White's question to you a moment ago, then you have to concede. You're conceding that there's some sort of a limited property interest. Are you not?
I'm saying under the common law there is a right to receive the service so long as you obey the rules and regulations.
And under the statute of the state, under the state law.
Under common law regarding utilities.
Mm-hmm. Is that enforced in Tennessee?
Of course, sir. It's enforced everywhere, just like Jackson versus Metropolitan. They had to furnish services to anybody that would pay for it. And if they didn't pay for it, then the question was, could they cut it off?
Well, what I want to know is that the utility cuts a person off, doesn't tell them why, doesn't send them a bill, doesn't do anything, just cuts them off. And would the person then have a 1983 suit for failure to provide an adequate notice beforehand? That's part of the issue in this case.
Well, and you're making the assumption that they're not sending any bill at all, making any claim.
Yes, I am.
Or if they send a bill, then
I didn't. I just said they didn't send any bill. They didn't give him any notice. Now what?
Your Honor, then I think they merely have a common law right to damages against the utility, and
it's not a constitutional right. So your answer is that there's
no violation of constitutional rights, despite
the fact that there's a property interest.
Well, I don't consider it a property interest for continued payment, continued credit being given.
Let me ask you a hypothetical question to see if it will shed some light on this problem, on your position for me. A newspaper is not a public utility, is it?
That's right.
But they serve people at their homes with a carrier service and bring the newspaper there. Would you say there's any obligation on the part of the newspaper, enforceable obligation, to deliver newspapers just because people want it, or can they refuse anyone they want?
I think they can refuse it like any other credit transaction, sir.
Now, a utility, on the other hand, is not free to refuse service, is it, in Arkansas?
And it's not free to refuse service except under its rules and regulations if it hasn't been paid for past service.
I mean, in the first instance, if a customer calls up and says, I want water, gas, and electricity.
It must serve them if it has the reasonable means to do it at that time.
Yes.
If they live 5 miles from town, we could say we won't do it.
My question assumes they're on the main line.
Yes, sir.
So that distinction is of some importance to this case, isn't it?
Yes, sir. And we say that, in answer again to Justice White, if they didn't get a bill to begin with, then they've received some damages and they would have an adequate remedy of law, but it's not a constitutional right to continue paying it on the basis of not paying a bill and not having a continued entitlement to credit while they're litigating for past credit extended.
Now, the newspaper could give you a subscription free because they might think it was good for them to have you on their subscriber list, but charge me, your next-door neighbor, the full price, could they not?
Yes, sir.
But they can't do that in a utility.
No, sir. They have to charge everyone the same rates without discrimination.
But none of this has to do with the Constitution.
No, sir. It does not.
Right.
Well, but if I walk into Macy's and ask them to charge something for me, I take it, even if Macy's is partly owned by the city of New York, they are free to tell me, no, we're not going to charge.
That's right.
The fact that I may be a delinquent creditor and they haven't sent me a bill doesn't mean that they have that something in the Constitution gives me a property right to get my next transaction charged. But am I not right in thinking that Tennessee treats the utility somewhat differently than it would Macy's?
Our Patterson case says that you may adopt a rule that you can terminate for non-payment. And our other cases say that you can still terminate for non-payment even if there is a dispute because the termination is at your peril and the utility could be sued for damages if they made that improper termination.
Mr. Graves, I had a question that I wanted to ask earlier because it's really a threshold question. How is your client, Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division of the City of Memphis, amenable to suit at all under 1983 because of the doctrine of Monroe against Pape and the City of Kenosha and others?
Your Honor, we considered the fact of saying that we were not a person. We are also sued by our individual commissioners. We were being asked for declaratory relief so that the previous counsel before me did not choose to raise that argument as to whether they were a person because we also had our individual commissioners sued who could be charged and were charged under the charter with making the policy, just as individual boards of education or individual other members of boards would make policy.
I
so we didn't raise that.
The Judge Peck's opinion in the Court of Appeals says that the district court, correctly I think says, that the district court after trial found that there was no civil rights jurisdiction over municipally owned MLG and W. He footnotes that to a case, and he says nothing further about it in the entire opinion. He neither affirms, nor the court neither affirms nor reverses that. But isn't that a correct holding under the...
Yes, sir, it is, but the counsel who tried this before me chose not to raise the question
of whether
or not...
But that's been decided, that you're out of the case, hasn't it? By the district court, and it was not reversed in the Court of Appeals.
Your Honor, I don't think he really was finding that. I think he was finding that we were not violating due process in this. He may have mentioned that, but he still entered his decree and said we should have a better notice and we should give credit. And our individual commissioners were also sued in this case as well.
Would you agree that if the Court of Appeals through Judge Peck is correct in saying that the district court held that you were not suable under 1983, that that was a correct holding.
Yes, sir.
Because you are a municipality.
Yes, sir. We are under the charter of the city of Memphis and just a division of it.
Of the city of Memphis, aren't you?
Yes, sir. And please, the court, I would like to talk a little bit about the facts on our hearing and notice, because we consider...
Well, first of all, before you get that, do you concede then that there's property?
No, sir, I'm not conceding. No, sir, I'm not conceding there's property, because I don't consider there's that independent source by state statute or otherwise that you've said in Board of Regents versus Roth and others that makes it that what we're talking about is the general law of utilities, which would apply to a private or a municipality, which says that you can make reasonable rules, which include, at your peril, terminating someone for what you consider non-payment.
Right. So now when you're moving on to talk about the procedures that you do provide, you're saying, assuming arguendo, there was a deprivation of property, but only arguendo. Is that right?
That's right.
All right.
And yes. On that basis, sir,
Let me ask just one question on the property issue. Assume for a moment you have a customer who has paid his bills, and the utility admits he's paid his bill. Could the utility cut his services off without notice and so forth, without raising any federal question? I realize you'd have a state law liability.
Yes, sir.
You'd say there's no property interest.
No, sir. Because we've made an error in taking that service, he has the same common law actions to go in and ask for an injunction, to go in and said you've made a mistake.
I know he has a lot of state law remedies. Doesn't he also have a state law right to continued service? If he's paid his bills.
If he's paid his bill.
Now, why isn't that property within the meaning of the 14th Amendment?
Your Honor, the fact of whether or not the utility makes a mistake.
No mistake at all. They know it. They say we've just decided to cut you off. You paid your bills, but we're going to violate state law. We got all sorts of reasons. You're a bad person, whatever it may be. Does he have a federal property interest in having continued service? Does he have a property interest in continued service when he's paid his bills and everybody acknowledges he's paid his bills? Is that a property right within the meaning of the 14th Amendment? And if not, why not?
Your Honor, I think under the law of utilities, he has the right to a service, whether that makes it a constitutional right.
I'm not asking you as a matter of Tennessee law. That's admitted that he has.
That's admitted.
Now, why isn't that a property right within the meaning of the
14th
Amendment?
Because I don't think it reaches that independent source that the court has said must make it 14th Amendment. That is, by state law, rule, or understanding that you've done it. Now, if you say that is so, then you've made it. But when you look at the education case of Goss versus Lopez and say because the state chose to provide the service and passed the statute, that made, and also a statute you must attend school, that made it federally protected. Well, we don't have that statute or that independent source.
But you have a state law that says you must provide the service when it's
No,
paid
sir,
for
it's
it.
Not a state law. It's just the regular law of utilities. It's just the common law.
But it's the law followed in the state of Tennessee,
yes,
isn't
sir.
It?
And every state.
Don't you have a decision of the Supreme Court of Tennessee to that effect?
Yes, sir.
You're not drawing a distinction, are you, between law declared by your court and law declared by your legislature?
I am, from the standpoint that they're declaring it as the common law for utilities throughout every state, Your Honor, and they're following the general rule. Now, if that makes it a constitutionally protected property right, then it may be. And yes. I didn't think it met the test of Roth.
In Roth that you cite, was there a state statute?
Yes, sir. You had a state statute that provided for free education and a state statute for compulsory attendance. When they suspended somebody, they should be given a hearing.
I'm thinking about Goss v. Lopez, I think.
Yes, sir. Yes.
I thought you cited Roth.
Roth was the tenure, yes, sir.
Was that a statutory right or one?
I think they sent it back to determine whether or not it was a de facto type of right, sir.
But would that have made a difference? Suppose the university board had prescribed tenure.
Well, our rules and regulations also provide that if you pay your bills, you get the service. But if you don't pay your bills, you don't get the service. So that's the distinction between them.
I suppose in Tennessee there are some privately owned utilities, are
yes,
there not?
Yes, and they're on the Public Service Commission.
Now, those privately owned utilities function by virtue of a grant or a franchise from the state, do they not?
Yes, sir.
I assume... it's, as in other states, the franchise itself defines the right of every person within the reach of the service to receive that service if he pays for it.
Yes, sir.
Would you say with respect to a private utility that is or is not a property right in 14th Amendment terms?
Your Honor, if they were under state action, but some of the district court cases say because of those state statutes, that makes it a property right. On the other hand, I say that's no different than just the codification of the common law, and does that make it a property
right? In other words, you draw no distinction between a private utility in this respect and a public utility.
No, sir. We're still subject to damages and liability for failure to abide by our own rules and regulations. Your Honor, I would like to say something about our notice in this case. We sent out notices that not only had a final notice, but it also had a flyer in it that said if you had any dispute, in some cases it didn't say the word dispute, but it says if you're having difficulty paying your bill, come to the credit counselors. We think that the record clearly shows that we were giving adequate notice and a hearing for this reason. When somebody gets a utility bill, they say, I didn't use that much service. You made a mistake. I've got too high a bill. When you talk to the light, gas, and water, we reread 33,000 meters during 1973, so we were cognizant of any complaint and did something about it of any high bill. If you had difficulty paying your bill or you had something to matter with it, 62,000 people came into the credit office during that year and were handled by the credit officials. When the Crafts had their problems because they bought a duplex and the real estate agent said, don't pay any attention to the fact that you've got 2 meters here, then the Crafts had help. Even though they had 25 days from the time they got their bill until they got final notice to they got a cutoff, they went to the utility. They got their meter put back in. They got their utilities on, and they lasted from June until September when a meter reader went by and they said, our check's in the mail, and it didn't cut off. When they were cut off in October, they went to the utility, and somebody must have told them at the utility that you've got 2 meters. You ought to have them combined if you don't want a duplex with 2 meters. They did it. They didn't pay their bill again when they were cut off in November, even though they were getting 2 bills for not double billing, split billing, each meter registering the service. When they came back in November, their utilities were cut back on, and they were put on budget billing, and they paid $25 or so, and $100 were delayed. When in December, they were to be cut off again, December 28th, they called up and got an extension until January 8th in this time. The meters were finally combined because the electricians and plumber had made a mistake in combining which ones that were there. So that you can't say that we were callous toward the Crafts or in anybody, and that we consider that when we were giving that information and handling the people and adopting a budget procedure, and that when you have a dispute, regardless of whether it's an amount of a bill or whether you owe that much or whether you owe it at all, if you go to Macy's, you go to the credit department, to any big place. When you go to the utility, those notices, which are not in the opinion but in the appendix, say MLGW Credit Department at the bottom. So that's where
Macy's,
you know,
isn't
to go.
Government. Macy's,
sir?
Macy's is not government.
That's right, sir.
The 14th Amendment applies only to state.
That's right,
state
sir. But when we give you notice of who to come to, and we say MLGW Credit Department or credit counselors, or if you're having difficulty paying your bill, I think common sense tells you that you go to the credit department. That's the people that sign the bill, and that the record shows that we handled over 100,000 people through either the credit department or calling up to get extensions or rereading their meters, and we did it. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Daniel.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This case arose as a result of a dispute that developed in Memphis, Tennessee between Mr. and Mrs. Willie S. Craft and the Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division. Without going into the details of that dispute, I think it's fair to say that the dispute existed over a period of several months prior to the filing of this suit, during which time the Craft Utility Services were terminated on several occasions, and also during which time the Crafts made good faith efforts, as the district court found, to resolve their dispute with Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division. The dispute that developed occurred because of double computer billing that was being sent to the Crafts residents. And during this period, Mrs. Craft made several efforts, even to the point of going to the offices of Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division and spending the entire day in an effort to ascertain the reasons for the terminations and to try to straighten out the problem. There's one important fact that should be noted in this that's important to a proper resolution of this case, and that is that Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division, then as now, has no orderly dispute resolution process. And that's why Mrs. Craft was unable to resolve her dispute with the Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division. Mr. Graves has indicated that Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division did not harshly treat the Crafts. The record is quite the contrary in this case. On one occasion, when Mrs. Craft called to explain that her bill had been paid, she was met with the response, "Pay it again." And on another occasion, when she was talking with someone at the Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division concerning her bill, she was actually cursed by one of the employees. But the important point is that no dispute resolution process exists within Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division.
You have a small claims? Excuse me, go ahead. You have a small claims court system in Tennessee?
We have what's called a general sessions court, Your Honor, but it is not a small claims court in the sense that no lawyers are allowed to appear, such as we have in some states.
Suppose the notice said you haven't paid your bill. If you have any complaints about it, come and see Mr. So-and-so at room so-and-so between the hours of so-and-so. Bring any information you have. Bring your lawyer if you want to, and we'll hear your side of the story to see if we've made a mistake. Would that be enough to satisfy you before there's a cutoff?
I think a notice of that sort is the type that we're asking.
So your answer is yes?
It's hard to say yes to a specific notice without seeing it in print and going over it.
But you don't, for example, claim that before there's a cutoff there has to be some independent hearing examiner or a full adversary trial.
Well, your question was directed to the notice, but as I think what we're asking for is the type of notice that you just mentioned to give the person an opportunity to for some type of hearing. That would only have to be at the first stage an informal conference with a responsible official at Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division. And then if it's not resolved at that stage, I think there should be an informal hearing before an impartial hearing.
You mean
examiner.
before a termination of service?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, what authority do you have for that in our case?
Well, I think in numerous cases decided by this court, such as Goldberg versus Kelly. I think before the termination of welfare service in that case.
Well, what kind of a hearing was that?
That was an informal hearing before an independent hearing examiner prior to the termination. Let me make clear that when I say...
Well, when you say an independent hearing examiner, did not Goldberg against Kelly simply say that it must be within the organization, the granting organization, but a different person?
That is correct, and I wanted to point out we are not necessarily asking for someone outside the company, so long, even if it is an employee of the company, so long as that person has the independence to look at the case fairly and to make a decision in favor of the consumer, we feel that that would be adequate.
Well, don't you think that the natural urge of a utility to sell as much of its products as possible gives them a certain amount of independence in that respect?
I suppose it does, but the record in this case indicates that they also have some problems in resolving disputes that developed between customers. And one of the problems that Mrs. Craft had was that the persons that she was communicating were lower-level employees who really did not have the authority to resolve any dispute that might have developed. We are saying that the situation would probably be improved if a responsible company official, in other words, a higher-level employee...
Mr. Daniel, is the reason for that it's a public utility or that's a state?
I think it's because it is a state in this case.
You wouldn't have any claim unless the defendant is a state.
Right? That's correct, under the Jackson case.
State within the meaning of the 14th Amendment.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And what about the other officers?
I'm not sure
what... The commissioners?
Well, the...
They state officers?
Well, they are employees of the city, at least insofar as they are officials of the Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division. They are state officers, yes.
Well, they're president and vice president.
Yes.
So far you have largely, in response to questions from the court, addressed yourself to the due process aspect of the case, Mr. Daniel. Do you think the Sixth Circuit's analysis of the property interest question, which I suppose logically comes before the due process inquiry, is satisfactory in the light of Roth and Sinderman?
No, I don't think their analysis is... as full as it should be. I think at the time this case was decided, they were just relying primarily on other cases. I think, as this court has pointed out, there must be reference to whether this property interest exists under state law. But I think it's clear that under the state law of Tennessee, a person has a right to receive utility service, and the utility supplier has a duty to supply. So I think... an analysis of a proper analysis under Roth and Sinderman and more recent decisions of this court, that there clearly is a property interest under state law.
And you did not appeal or seek cert from that portion of the Sixth Circuit's opinion which held that where the bill is undisputed, judgment goes for the defendant in the case.
That is correct. We do not assert that the customers have the right to free utility service. There's no question but what utility service may be terminated for non-payment in Tennessee. It's just that we question the right of the utility service under the 14th Amendment to terminate utility service while a dispute is pending.
But I want to be clear that you are not asking that the fact finder to resolve this dispute must be independent and neutral apart from the utility.
That is correct.
It can be an employee of the utility. You said, I think, a responsible representative?
A responsible company official. I think
well,
that
official?
Would be adequate.
I'm not sure what official means.
Well, I think there was a distinction made in the Palmer case of the Sixth Circuit in that an official or an officer of the company would have more freedom to rule in favor of the customer than a lower-level employee.
Mr. Graves suggests you go to the credit department. Would that be okay?
Well, no, I don't think that would be okay because the problem, as the record in this case indicates, is that the employees in the credit department are concerned primarily with getting people to pay their bills. They're not concerned with resolving disputes. The record in this case indicates that they don't even have the time to do that because there's so many calls that they get each day, there's no way possible that they can deal with disputes concerning bills. The only thing they can deal with is people who are having difficulty paying an admitted liability.
Mr. Daniel, may I ask you a question, please? I'd like to ask about your objection to the notice and the Court of Appeals holding on the notice and put to one side the hearing problem. And also, of course, I'm just asking about the constitutional requirement as to an adequate notice as opposed to what a commission might say is desirable in the sense of telling the customer how to go in and straighten out the dispute. Your point, as I understand it, is that the notice, although it told the customer of the harm that was about to occur, namely it was going to be cut off, it did not explain to the customer the procedure to be followed in avoiding that harm.
That's correct.
Now, is there any precedent that you know of under the 14th Amendment for holding that a notice must do more than tell the person to be harmed about the prospective harm, but must go further and, in effect, give him legal advice as to what his possible remedies must be?
Well, I think the holdings of this court indicate that the question of notice and hearing is always variable according to the circumstances of a particular case. And I can't cite any specific holding that would require that, but I think that
benefits?
Under recent decisions of this court, the type of notice that has been required in certain cases, such as Morrissey versus Brewer, was a very specific notice, and it informed the person of more than just the action that was about to be taken. It also informed the person of the steps that they might take to prevent the threatened harm. The problem in this case is that Mrs. Kraft attempted to take some steps to prevent the threatened harm. She acted as any reasonable person would and went to the offices of Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division, but was unable to resolve the dispute because she was never informed either there or in the notice of what,
see,
what
often
she
I
do.
Suppose the in a serious matter that when a citizen gets notice of something about to happen, one thing he can do is ask a lawyer for help. Presumably, if either of these people asked the lawyer for help, they would have been straightened out in a hurry.
Well, I'm not even sure that it would have been straightened out in a hurry because
you don't think
there was
a letter
no
to the president of the company says you terminate this service, you're going to get sued for $3 million or something like that might not have gotten action?
That's possible, but my only point is there's no dispute resolution process within Memphis Light, Gas, and Water. So
how
even
often, does the record tell us how often there are disputes about the amount of the bill as opposed to questions of credit and things like that?
The only indication in the record as far as numbers is that during the year 1973, I believe, when this case was being litigated, there were something like 33,000 high bill complaints. Now, as to whether that can be classified as a dispute, I don't know, but I think that it probably would be. This is certainly different from some of the cases in this area, such as the one that Your Honor decided in the Seventh Circuit, where the record indicated that there were only a small number of disputes that developed over a certain time period. And also, I believe in the Lucas case, which Your Honor decided, there was a process within the company for resolving disputes, and most of them were, in fact, resolved prior to termination.
That's
of service.
That's right. It's right there, and it's required by state regulation.
That's correct. Another important factor there is that the Public Service Commission in that case, since it was a privately owned utility, had the authority and did in fact intervene on many occasions and halt the termination of service while the dispute was being resolved. In this case, the Public Service Commission has no jurisdiction over Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division, and there is nobody that can intervene like that and halt the termination while the dispute is being resolved.
What? The court wouldn't have to supervise this, would they?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor.
That's what worries me.
I think all we're asking the court to do is to set up or to order Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division to set up a dispute resolution process. It would not mean that every time a person had a dispute concerning their utility service that they could run into federal court for
why
a resolution.
Not?
Well, I think if they there would be no right of action in federal court to resolve the dispute. The claim here is that the 14th Amendment is violated because due process is not being provided.
Well, I mean, due process is a, you know, it's about like that, isn't it? Well, who would decide how much due process was going on?
Well, I think we're asking.
I mean, if your point, you know, you said somebody cursed her over the phone. Well, if they put that person in charge of this division, that wouldn't help, would it?
I suppose not, Your Honor.
Well, what would help?
Well, I think what would help is, as we've discussed previously, to have a hearing examiner who has the responsibility to hear disputes that develop between consumers and Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division, who has the authority to render a decision.
And to enforce it?
And to enforce that decision.
How can you do that in a public utility?
Well, I would.
You mean he could enforce it, say, tell the chairman of the board, or the, what is it, the council, or whatever this thing's called?
The commissioners of the utility.
So he'd be over them.
I don't think he would necessarily be over them. I really don't see a problem developing that Your Honor has anticipated. I assume enough good faith on the part of Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division that if they have a hearing examiner and he hears the case and orders that the utilities be turned back on, that he would be a high enough company official that he could order lower-level employees to turn the utility service back on.
Now, that's the first time you've used the term hearing examiner. Previously, you had said, I thought, any responsible employee of the company.
Well,
there's quite a difference between that and a hearing examiner. That has some connotations that responsible official does not have.
Well, if there's any confusion there, I was using the terms interchangeably, that the person who is hearing the case could be a responsible company official.
It's sort of an ombudsman type.
That is correct, Your Honor.
You use the term hearing the case, which certainly, I would think, does nothing to dispel the fears that some of us may share with Justice Marshall. If this is a case that goes before a hearing examiner, you really have a brand new division of the utility. Are you suggesting that formal a procedure is required simply by the language in the 14th Amendment that says no property shall be taken without due process?
No, I think if we look at what the Sixth Circuit did, for example, in the Palmer case, is an indication of what I'm talking about. There, they required that a responsible company official within the utility supplier be able to hear the dispute in an informal manner and make the decision as to whether service should be terminated or not, so that while the person hearing the dispute was an employee of the official, they nevertheless conducted an informal type dispute resolution process. But they would not necessarily have to be completely disassociated from the utility supplier.
Well, suppose the notice said if you have you owe some money, you're going to be cut off in 20 days unless you pay. If you have any objections, file your suit in court, and you can ask for a preliminary injunction. If you can satisfy the ordinary standards for a preliminary injunction, why, of course, the service wouldn't be cut off. But if you can't satisfy them, it will be put off. The service will be cut off, but, of course, then you can go ahead and try your lawsuit and get damages if you win. This is a state court suit. That's the notice you get. Would that satisfy the 14th Amendment, or do you think the 14th Amendment requires an administrative hearing?
I think the 14th Amendment requires some type of opportunity for hearing prior to the termination of service. I do not think that the common law remedy of suing for damages in state court would be adequate. Now, this court recently in Ingraham versus Wright held that a common law suit for damages was adequate in the context of corporal punishment. But I think that case is quite different from here. First of all, the governmental interest involved there in school discipline.
You mean a full court hearing isn't good enough procedure to satisfy the due process clause?
The problem with the full court hearing in that situation is the burden of proof is switched to the customer to show that he is right and the utility service is wrong.
Yes.
That's a reverse of the normal common law procedure that one asserting something due has the burden of proving that it's due. It puts the burden on the customer to hire a lawyer, pay the litigation expenses required to institute.
Well, suppose you have this administrative setup the way you want it, and you have a so-called responsible company official. Wouldn't it be enough under our cases if, after hearing the customer side of the story, he said, "I think there is probable cause to believe that you haven't paid your bill, and that you owe us some money, and there's probable cause to cut the service off"? Isn't that sufficient? He doesn't have to make some final decision, just has to say some probable cause for it.
I think that might be sufficient as an initial process, but as the Sixth Circuit required in the Palmer case, what we are asking is that if he makes that decision, there still should be some type of informal hearing where a written decision is rendered. Now,
this is before the cutoff?
Not necessarily before the cutoff.
Well, that's what we're talking about right now,
before
the cutoff. Before
the cutoff, That might be sufficient under the decisions of this court.
Well, how about, can you say whether it would or not be sufficient?
I think it would be sufficient before the cutoff, as long as, at least after the cutoff, there would be a more formalized hearing. Or
administrative, but it still has to be administrative.
That's correct.
Could the person have one a month? Have a hearing once a month?
I suppose it's conceivable that a person could abuse the process in that way, but I don't think the fact that there might somewhere be a customer who would abuse the process would mean that we should not that we should abandon the requirements of the 14th Amendment.
If the complaint is, which I don't know about you, but I have the same complaint every month, my bill is too much. So I would go there each month and have a hearing. And just all I'd say is, this is too much. And the company would say, well, here's the meter reading. Then what else would you do? Nothing.
That's correct. I suppose it's possible.
Well, does that seem silly to you?
It does, and I don't think most people would abuse the process in that way, because what we're talking about here is real disputes that people have concerning the utility service.
You were double billed, which obviously was a mistake.
That's correct.
And you never have a hearing with who made the mistake. You never have a hearing with the computer.
That's correct. You would not.
So I don't see what the hearing would be about.
Well, the hearing, such as in the Kraft case, would be about why the Krafts were getting two bills every month rather than one that most customers get, and whether that bill was correct or not.
That was partly related to the fact that they had an off-again, on-again program on their own part. Two meters, and then 1 meter, and then 2 meters. They brought on some of these problems by their own indecision, didn't they not, or changes of decision?
Well, except for the fact that even though they were aware that they had 2 meters, they thought and were in fact told by a Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division employee that one of the meters was bolted off. And so they thought that service was only coming through 1 meter. And I think, as the district court found, Mr. and Mrs. Kraft were making every effort to find out what the problem was and were ready and willing to pay the bill that was due. It's just that they could not understand why they were getting those two bills, and Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division seemed unable to explain it to them.
Now, this has been litigated for nearly 5 years, hasn't it?
Well, it started in 1974, so about 4 years.
73, I think.
Well, the dispute started in 73. That's correct. The suit was not actually filed until 74. If the court please, what we're asking this court to do in terms of requiring due process here is, as this court has done in numerous cases, is to balance the private interest that is involved here and the government's interest. The private interest that is involved here is an extremely important interest. It's the interest in the very means to life in some situations. We're talking about water service, gas, and electrical service, which in the cold winter months provide the means for heat in most municipalities in this country. So the significance of this interest is quite important. Termination of this interest can cause serious harm to a customer, and in some cases has even caused death. And so we're not talking about a situation like this court dealt with in Ingraham versus Wright, where we're talking about corporal punishment of students. We're talking about the potential for much more serious harm to the plaintiffs. We also have to balance that against the government's interest involved here. The government's interest, of course, is preserving scarce physical resources. But there's no reason that Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Division cannot provide the type of notice and hearing that we are requesting within the time frame that they presently terminate service and still be able to preserve their scarce physical resources. And the fact that a person gets a hearing does not mean that they are not going to have to pay the bill. If it's found that the customer is incorrect, they will nevertheless have to pay the bill.
And also the cost of the hearing.
And the cost of the hearing. We would concede that,
Your
Honor.
Could you tell me why this is a proper 1983 suit?
Well, if the court please, we're dealing here with a property interest under the 14th Amendment. And, of course, the source of...
I'm really going to Mr. Justice Stewart's question to your colleague.
As to whether Memphis Light Gas and Water Division is a person?
Yes.
Well, I think that issue has really not been raised, but I think...
Well, and it's a jurisdictional issue, though, isn't it?
Yes.
So isn't it always open?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, what about it then?
Well, I think that we have sued individual defendants here, commissioners of Memphis Light Gas and Water Division, who clearly are persons under Section 1983, even though it's questionable whether Memphis Light Gas and Water Division itself is a person.
Well, you say it's questionable. What do you think the answer is?
I think they're probably not, because in Memphis, the Memphis Light Gas and Water Division is not a separate corporation. It is a part of the city.
So this is this party, to the extent that Memphis Gas and Electric Water Division is a party here, it shouldn't be.
That's correct, Your Honor. I would agree with that.
And let's assume there were some damages here. Would it be paid out of city funds?
I don't know the answer to that, since the damages would be...
What if they were to be paid out of city funds? Then are the individuals persons?
I think that whether the damages were paid out of city funds would not make any difference as to whether they are persons under Section 1983.
Would it make any difference under the 11th Amendment?
No.
I don't believe it would.
Because it's a city.
Because it's a city. That's correct, John. I did want to raise one point in that regard. Mr. Justice Blackmun raised the issue of mootness in this case and raised the question as to whether there is a damage issue still open. It's the respondent's position that there is a damage issue still open in this case if this court affirms the holding of the Sixth Circuit. There were no damages ordered at the district court level because the district court held that we had no due process right. But if this case is remanded on the holding that the plaintiffs did have a right to due process prior to termination of service, I think the issue of damages would still be an open question. And for that reason, the case is not moot. In addition to that, on the claims for declaratory and injunctive relief, I think that this case would come within that class of cases which are capable of repetition yet evading review, as set out by previous decisions of this court, and so that it would not be moot for that reason.
Mr. Daniel, in addition to the claim that there was a deprivation of property here without due process of law, there was also a claim on behalf of a party named Holmes that there was a denial of equal protection of the law by the defendant.
That's correct.
Nobody's talked about that. What happened to that in the Court of Appeals, and what's your position?
That issue, we believe, has been finally decided by the Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. There was no, that issue was not raised by the petitioners.
So that's out of the case, is it?
That's correct.
All right. That was a refusal to install, I think, wasn't it?
That is correct, Your Honor. And the Sixth Circuit held that there was a denial of equal protection, and I believe the petitioners
and there was no appeal from that.
Have conceded that point.
I see. Thank you.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Graves? You have
I
just
have one sentence. I agree with Justice Marshall that everyone complains about the amount of a utility bill, and so that it's a question of whether it's a dispute or not. And we say by our notice to come to the credit department that we established a hearing procedure because the evidence was that our hearing our credit counselors usually have 15 to 20 years of service and are competent people, and so they would be ones. And you need 10 or 12 or 15 people because we had 235,000 electric customers, and we feel that establishing that initial contact, and the crafts waited until their utilities had the notice and had been terminated, and then they came and they got help and advice by telling them, combine your meters, put you on a budget payment. And it wasn't double billing, but split billing, because they got the service through each meter. Thanks.
That doesn't solve the problem which seems to be hanging in air, whether their due process right, such as the Sixth Circuit has outlined it, is satisfied if they don't get the answer they like.
Your Honor, I don't think they can, that everybody gets the answer they like about utility bills in this, because I think a utility could not compromise and give away the utilities just on the basis of settling it, that they would have to attempt to charge what was reasonably said by the meter to the person.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next.